Welcome back to the Deeper Dive Podcast, produced locally in the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Washington, D.C., here at Sacred Heart Roman Catholic Church in La Plata, Maryland. My name is Bill Winnell, as always, joined by Monsignor Charles Pope. Good afternoon, Monsignor.
Good afternoon.
And Father Larry Swink. Father, how are you?
Hey, doing well. Good to be here.
Today, we're going to talk about the latest declaration, papal declaration from the Vatican, entitled Human Dignity in English. And Father Larry, get us started.
Okay, great. Well, great, folks. I thought we would, when these letters come out from the Vatican, a lot of times, or maybe you didn't know it came out, so don't worry if you didn't. But
You're blessed indeed, right? You don't know these.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it doesn't even cross your mind. But they came out with the Dicastery, the Doctrine of the Faith came out with it, a declaration, sort of a teaching, called Dignitas Infinita, unquote. And Monsignor Pope doesn't really like that title. We'll talk about why, just because there's some existential, something a little bit off theologically with it, but still, I'll take another side. I think there's, in the document itself, explains why it can be misleading. But it is, I would say, you know, I read it today, Monsignor Pope and Bill, I read this document today. It took me about a couple, I just kept, you know, going back and forth for about a couple hours. And I would say I'd give it a solid B. I thought it was a good document. I don't know, it just crammed a lot in it that I thought you could have taken maybe a couple of these and just like really unpack them. Maybe there could have been more said about certain things that are more, I guess, relevant to today's culture. But I thought it was good. So let's start off with the, this whole thing of dignity. And Monsignor, your thoughts on the title, and then we'll go into the document itself.
Well, I think can one of you explain, I know we kind of talked about this during the last document that was released, but just for those maybe who didn't hear, again, real quick refresher on the difference between a declaration versus encyclical versus other things released from the Vatican.
Oh boy. Well, you really put us on the spot with that one, Bill. There are different, it's different degrees. I'll let Monsignor Pope take that one, but let me take a guess. I'm going back to 7 or 8 times. A declaration is a below an encyclical. It's a lower level letter, correct? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's not written by the Pope even here. It's written by Cardinal Fernandez, and it is, the Pope reviewed it and gave his approval for its publication, but it isn't like an encyclical that would be written by the Pope. Should have a higher degree. So it's authoritative in the sense of it's something to be taken seriously. It isn't, it is nothing, no one's saying even an encyclical is necessarily infallible. It's just a question, though, of kind of a slightly less elevated than an encyclical because mainly the authorship. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good. So I would say maybe if I could then, Father, just to talk a little bit about the title. Now, look, let's accept the fact that it could be, when it says here, the title of it, Dignitas Infinita, that we have here a kind of a strange, I thought, well, they must be talking about God's dignity. You know, I thought, I remember hearing that this title, this is a couple of weeks ago, and I thought, well, that's a reference to God. But it, of course, not. It's not. And let me read you the opening sentence. Every human person possesses an infinite dignity, inalienably grounded in his or her very being, which prevails in and beyond every circumstance, state, or situation that a person may ever encounter. Well, wait, wow, that's very expansive. And I think it's just plain wrong. Only God has an infinite dignity. Now, if you mean there's a certain kind of hyperbolic flourish here, like infinite dignity, you know, I mean, we talk like that in homilies and things, perhaps, but this, in a careful theological document, you might wish that maybe they would have been more careful. It raises questions about the seriousness of this understanding of dignity. Human dignity can be diminished. It can be lost. Thomas says this, recent popes like Benedict have said that, you know, for example, he makes a remark about the prodigal son. We're all familiar with that story. And Pope Benedict there states, you know, that he lost his dignity through his sin. You know, in a way, that's what the parable says. He sank so low, the prodigal son did, that he was looking up to pigs. You know, he thought those pigs ate pretty well. Right. And so that it says here that Pope Benedict says that if we are not careful, we can become like the prodigal son and we will lose our human dignity. Whereas this document seems to be in a very, more than just a hyperbolic flourish, but if you read the whole first sentence, suggesting that nothing can ever diminish, including our own sins, this infinite dignity that we have. Well, if that's the case, then I think hell has to go out of existence. I think that any sense of sin or anything, nothing, you know, I'm afraid it's not careful. Right. That's all. Okay. That's all.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good, judgment on matter and a critique. I would argue though, the document itself clarifies that. And actually in the section where it says fundamental clarification, it talks about the different types of dignity that we have. And I thought this is really well written. I've read this in other documents and, you know, theology and so forth, but it says that there's a full fourfold distinction of the concept of dignity: ontological dignity, moral dignity, social dignity, and existential dignity. And it says the most important of these is the ontological dignity that can, and in essence, that God's creation, we will always be considered loved by him, I guess, infinitely, that what he made, even if we go against our dignity, it can, our essence, who we are ontologically, is always good. You know, now we can destroy that, and the document says that. But let's go on to that. Maybe it's good to understand, like, because I thought this is a very interesting point about there is a part about us that is just never diminished, even in the prodigal son. Even amidst his sin, and even though he messed up his dignity, but let's talk about these different ones. So, let's start with ontological dignity. It says this: ontological dignity is indelible and remains valid beyond any circumstance which the person may find themselves. Okay, so but then next sentence, when we speak of moral dignity, we refer to how people exercise their freedom. So one, a person can destroy their moral dignity, their connection with God, but who they are as a person is never destroyed. Mm-hmm. Is that a good way of explaining it?
So I think that's well said, and I'm glad you pointed that out, that later in the document, they seem to kind of make some distinctions that are important in this very expansive opening sentence. And it's too bad that it takes them 8 paragraphs to get to it. But I think maybe if they could have avoided my concern, if they just used the word intrinsic dignity, there is an intrinsic inalienable dignity that comes to us simply as God's creatures, but even more so as God's sons and daughters by baptism. But the human person does have human being has this intrinsic dignity from God that cannot be taken away by anyone else. It's not given by anyone else, and it can't be taken by anyone else. And I agree with that. But it doesn't pertain to finite creatures to have infinite anything, really, in a certain sense. If we were just being strict and theological, and again, I might be just an old fuss budget here, Father Swink, but I just think that ideally, especially in the title of a document, one might want to have a little more doctrinal precision. That's all. And we'll leave it at that. I think we could get stuck on that. I don't mean you and I, but I mean people. Right. I've heard that out on the internet too. They're just writing the whole document off because the title is stupid. Bye-bye. You know, and I don't do that. I stay in the conversation. I think that's important. You know, we say, well, I wouldn't have worded it that way. How about that?
Yeah. Okay. I think that's fair. And then, but let's go back to sort of what the doctor's trying to say is they're trying to define what dignity means, and that where do human persons get their dignity? And first it's from God, right? Well, that's actually from being made in the image and likeness of God, that we have the classic definition that we have the use of reason, went into that, and he talked about how many cultures have disregarded that, that that's not what makes us human or have dignity. Also, freedom, they said, is a most gift from God, that even God draws us to him with his grace. He does so in a way that never violates our freedom. You know, like, we have a choice that we can make to follow God or not.
Yes.
And then he also said that Jesus elevates our human dignity. And it says in the mystery of the incarnation, the Son of God confirmed the dignity of the body and soul, which constitutes the human being. And so Christ elevates it. But it also makes the point is that there are violations to dignity, and that there are certain, it even says in the document that there are ways, there are violations against human dignity. We also, we have misinterpreted what the word itself means. So let's kind of dig into its words in dignity and then go into some of the violations that they went into.
Yeah.
So go ahead with dignity, Monsignor.
Well, you know, in the liturgy, for example, we have that expression "verae dignum et justum est." It is truly right and just. So, a person's dignity is, as we come from the hand of God, refers to the fact that God don't make junk. God made us rightly in accordance with His will. And yes, our human nature is damaged in a certain sense, but even none of that is able to remove the fact that, you know, we have been. Taken, you know, if you will, made by the hand of God. And that gets, of course, that should come out later on in the document. We can't think that we can replace God and think, well, God messed up. I'm supposed to be female, not male. That our dignity is as we come from the hand of God. God does not make junk. He does not make mistakes. And even if there are handicaps or physical deformities of some sort, even that can give God glory, and God has a plan. And none of this should ever be seen as the person is somehow forfeits their dignity, you know? So that'd be my first stab at it.
Okay. Well, there's an interesting sort of tie-in here is, you know, so first, we're made in the image of likeness. God elevates us. We're his creatures. We get that dignity. But the idea that sin can diminish this, we can treat people below their dignity. And there's ways, and I thought that was the part where I thought, wow, that's pretty powerful, that there are certain actions that are below our human dignity should never be practiced. Mm-hmm. And it really kind of mars what we're supposed to be seeing. Now, I think too, is that dignity doesn't come from what we do or how we look and all this other stuff, because I was thinking about this podcast that your secretary showed me about this woman named Lizzie Velasquez. I don't know if you've heard about this woman. She's a big online. And one day a friend of hers says, hey, go online and look up. Now she's born with a disease that she's unable to gain any weight. And half of her face is like, I mean, she's half of face is normal, but half of it is really deformed. Mm. So it was kind of like, and so she typed in on the internet, ugliest woman in the world, and her face popped up. And she said it was one of those moments. It was like the most crushing, moments in her life. But she said something that I knew at that moment, even though it was so horrific, they don't know what I suffer because of this disease. They didn't take away my dignity. And my dignity does not depend upon what I look like. Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that could be
and it's worth noting, by the way, the document takes up a topic that's sort of new, but it's still important, on social violence in a way. I think they call it social violence, but where people are on the internet saying and doing the most awful things about other human beings that they would very often never do while they're in person. And like to be able to look up on the internet and see your face pop up when you type in ugliest woman in the world is horrific that anybody would have ever put some kind of thing out there to that effect. And so there is a section in the document, which I think is worthwhile, that we ought to be careful. Now, we also have the extremes of that in our culture. Everything's hate speech. If it upsets me, you know, we're not talking about that, but I mean, really personal, ugly, unnecessary things that sometimes people can't even help about themselves. It's just, horrific. You're right. By the way, at the I just meant to mention earlier, the etymological root of the word dignum or dignity is worth or value. Okay. And we sometimes say, or something that's fitting or worth, it's worthy, you see? Okay. So that's maybe to sort of unpack the word a little bit more, just that would be enough said on that.
Okay. Yeah. Great. So one question I had too, Monsignor, is the difference that they make between ontological existence, dignity, and existential.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that
ontological versus existential.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, Father. The screen froze there a little on me. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to talk over you. I think, yeah, let's take an example. The ontological or intrinsic dignity that we have comes from God. It's not based on what we do or don't do. It's just there because God made us. Now, existential has to do more with how we conduct ourselves, whether our behavior is worthy, is dignified. And so we wouldn't want to say that there's no difference between Hitler and Mother Teresa. We always have to have Hitler around, and we certainly need Mother Teresa around. So there is certainly an ontological dignity that both of them possess as from the hand of God, but there's a great gulf and difference between them at the more existential level, where they may make decisions, good or ill, and that this tends to these actions are dignified or not, are worthy or not, and so on.
It's how we're living out our dignity as a human person, made in the image and likeness of God.
Yeah, and our behavior should reflect our dignity, but to one degree or another, it does or doesn't. And in some people, they very much mar the image of God in them and the dignity they have as a human person by the way they behave. They sometimes human beings act even worse than animals.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that's why it says here, and they quote Pope Benedict XVI. I'm sorry. Yes, it says, without the corrective supplied by religion, though reason too can fall prey to distortions as when it is manipulated by ideology or applied in a partial way that fails to take full account of the dignity of the human person, such as misuse of reason, social evils or totalitarian ideologies of the 20th century. Right. And one point that I think would point that out is, the idea, let's go back to the ugliest woman ever alive, Lizzie Velasquez. Let's look at something a little bit more, that's a terrible thing to say that about her, but let's take it. That was mentioned about abortion, that there is sort of a new onslaught of, I would say, what is that, where you try to make the perfect genetic, is that? What's that word?
Just perfectionism, I guess, huh?
Yeah, or genetics. What was it with Tywin?
Eugenics.
Eugenics, right?
Yeah.
Eugenics, but Hitler was trying to create this like perfect race by annihilating people he thought, quote unquote, imperfect. But that there's a new sort of onset of that. And one example that the document points out, but it's true in places like Iceland. I don't know if you know this, in Iceland, there is now one person in the country that has Down syndrome, and they also claim that they have destroyed autism, but they didn't. They failed to say how, which is by doing amniocentesis on the women, and if they came up positive for any of these genetic abnormalities, they would abort the babies, trying to make this perfect Iceland race. But go ahead. You can comment on that.
Well, I would just like to point out that ever since, Iceland has had more pernicious volcanic activity than ever before. In fact, one of their whole villages was completely, inundated, is basically destroyed. Now, they've always had volcanic activity there, but it's taken on a kind of a much more destructive quality than ever before. I'm not trying to say that's the wrath of God. I'm just going to say maybe they should be focusing more on volcanic activity than worrying about children with Down syndrome, huh? At least that.
Right. You know? Right.
And children with Down syndrome, like I say, they have dignity and there's great beauty in their lives.
Right. So what are some of the things that they talked about in specific? I mean, I don't have the whole document. Well, I do.
I can list the different type.
Yeah, let's go through the different themes. So what?
Yeah, they do have here. I'll just list basically very quickly the topics covered in the document. There's the drama of poverty.
Yep.
There's the questions of war, the travail of migrants, human trafficking, sexual abuse, violence, especially against women, abortion, euthanasia, assisted suicide, gender theory, sex change. Oh, they call it digital violence. I guess it was that's what I was talking about earlier, that violence and ugliness on the internet. And so those are some of the topics. It's a little selective. It's not like every single topic is covered. I might say that the document has something, excuse me, something of an unfinished quality to it in places. Almost as though they stopped short before they'd finish. But as I say, there is no topic on here about homosexuality. And in fact, the James Martin crowd and kind of objected to that fact that there's nothing in the document about them. It's always going to have to be about them.
It's interesting. I mean, there's nothing said in
one way or the other here.
One way or the other. Yeah. And but that goes to the fundamental point here is there's this understanding. Yeah. I mean, all these people that have same sex attraction, they're made in the image of God, they have dignity. But what they're asking is their actions dignifiable? And the answer would be no. Just like
the action isn't. Yeah.
The action is not. And that's, I think that's, and maybe they just said, well, let's just lay off that. But
it would also just published a document on that, which was, yeah. Okay. But enough said, but I think what we can say at least is this much is it's not covering every possible issue you can imagine, but there's some important ones here. And I want to just say,
war. What was your thought on the war?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's, well, dream on, you know, I mean, there's a lot of kind of dreaminess in this. And I think some things that are said much too strongly. So, for example, first of all, I'd like to announce I'm against war. Okay. I think war is a terrible thing. All right. So there's my disclaimer. But guess what? I don't always get to decide that. Sometimes war comes to us and we'd rather it not. But let me just read to you a couple of thoughts here that they have on war. It says they start out with a good point, which is a quote from the Catechism. While reaffirming the inalienable right to self-defense and the responsibility to protect those whose lives are threatened by unjust aggressors, it goes on that that's the quote. And then they say, we must, however, acknowledge that war is always a defeat of humanity. Now, and then it says this, no war is ever worth the tears of a mother who has seen her child mutilated or killed. No war is worth the loss of the life of even one human being. Now, wait a minute. That's just too absolute. You know, part of the human condition is that sometimes we ask some human beings to encounter a serious life-threatening situation to save others. This is part of being in the human family. We have firefighters. We have police officers who do that every day. I would not, you know, so as I say, I think somewhere in here, nobody likes war. So that's our disclaimer. Nobody wants war. But sometimes when it comes, we engage in it because it is necessary and in that sense, worthwhile, that we would ask others to endanger their life to restore justice or repel a threat of unjust aggression. And I to say that there's no worth in that, it seems to me to suggest that soldiers and others who have died in this thing kind of did so for no good reason. And that, I'm sorry, I wish I could live in a world where even the death of one human being in a war meant that it wasn't worth it. But I'm sorry, that's just not where we are. And it's a sad and tragic reality that sometimes in order to repel unjust aggression, we have to act violently, violently repel it. And it goes on to say here this, wars will not solve problems, but only increase them. Well, again, that's an overly general thing. It can solve certain issues. It can repel an unjust aggressor. It can, you know, but I will argue, I think that's arguable that wars almost never end things. They just sort of postpone it because people have memories and they come back at you again, you know. But I agree. I understand. I wish it could be different. I really do. But sometimes we're just in that situation. It goes on to say this: we can no longer think of war as a solution. Mm. Well, I'm sorry, but we wouldn't engage in it if it wasn't at least perceived as a solution on rare occasion. Unfortunately, tragically, as a last recourse, in other words, using the just war tradition here, it says here, we can no longer think of it as a solution because the risk will probably always be greater than the supposed benefits. Well, if that were the case, then rational human beings wouldn't conclude that we should go to war. And I think, you know, and finally this, they then dismiss the just war theory entirely. They just dismiss it, which I think is a big mistake. It says, it's difficult nowadays to invoke the rational criteria elaborated in earlier centuries that spoke of the possibility of a just war. Now, that's not really fair. That's not, the just war tradition doesn't seek to justify war so much as to limit it and keep it within some realm of justice. Because war is hell. It's a terrible thing. And so we need to be really careful before we go to war. And the just war tradition has the criteria there, you know. Jus ad bellum, you know, the idea that you can only go to war if it's a last recourse. Other things have been tried and found wanting. It's about a major issue and so on. There's criteria there. And once you're in a war, you have to limit yourself to being very serious about not killing non-combatants and you know, taking only the means necessary to bring forth an end to the threat. And so again, you can condemn the just war theory all you want, but it's all we've got. And I think it's a huge mistake. And the Holy Father's done this before, where he's been dismissive of the just war tradition that comes from St. Augustine and others. And he has, I think, well, what do you have to replace it with? Never again war. Well, you can live in your little la-la land all you want, but there's going to be war. It comes to us, whether we like it or not. And I wish it could be different. I really, really do.
Yeah, so, I think they would say ideally, as we all agree, we would avoid war at all costs. And I think that's always been the premise of the church, is it's a last resort. And and that's what the just war theory says.
Yeah.
Is that all other ways of trying to resolve the situation have been utilized. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, you make a great point. It could be maybe reworded like, of course, we do not want war because people are killed and hurt and their dignity and, you know, mm-hmm. dignity is diminished or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. However, in a perfect world, that would be so, but we still have, if in mm-hmm. last resort, we use the just war theory, you know, maybe something like that.
It was, and also the catechism. Oh, go ahead.
No, Bill. I was just going to say, I did find that interesting that Cardinal Fernandez, this is a, you know, he puts this direct quote from Francis in that paragraph mm-hmm. that you were reading, that this, you know, that Pope mm-hmm. Francis underscores this by saying we can no longer think of a war as a solution because the risk will probably be greater than its supposed benefits, you know, mm-hmm. and then end quote, you know, never again war. So not written by the Holy Father, but certainly it's interesting he quoted him directly here.
He's actually quoting Paul VI there. Yeah. I mean, that expression.
Yep.
And again, how many wars have we had since then? It's lovely for someone to stand up and say that, but you're living in a world where it's probably going to come to you, even if you don't seek it. And the question is, how do you behave yourself? And I think that's what the just war tradition was about. And I think that woe to us if we just went out to war to exploit and take things that aren't ours. That has been sadly a tradition in the human family, that sometimes nations just go out and fight wars to take territory. But at the end of the day, we generally, at least in America, I think, are more often fighting a defensive war. I would also add that there are serious problems in the world today with what we might call a kind of an industry that sets up around war. And I'm very critical of that too. So let's at least accept, yeah, there's things to be concerned about here. But I do think that, for example, in the Catechism, it also states that nations not only have a right to defend against unjust aggression, but a duty. there is a duty, and that's why we have also police forces and, well, to some extent, firefighters, which is, it's a different kind of war, but you see the idea. We have these things because there are not just rights, but duties. And by the way, defending your life against an unjust aggressor who's seeking to kill you is not a breaking of the fifth commandment. It is a keeping of it. The catechism says that. That's almost an exact quote. To defend yourself, even if necessary by violence unto death, to save your life from an unjust aggressor is not a breaking of the commandment. It is a keeping of it, since the first life one is obliged to protect is their own. Now, this isn't just willy-nilly. There are times where we have to accept death for the sake of others, but most people have obligations too. So a father shouldn't just willy-nilly put himself in and let himself get killed. He has to live for his family. And so most people have certain duties that have to be weighed there too. We could go on forever about it. I'm just saying, I think clearly in terms of human dignity, we need to think a lot more about that when we go to war. And I think the document's right on that. War should be much less frequent. And we've gotten into a lot of, I would say, foolish, pointless struggles and wars in this country over the last, well, most of my adult life. We haven't even won half of them.
Yeah.
You know, it gets bad.
Monsignor, there was a lot in this document. There's a couple of interesting points I thought was on the part on violence against women, which was really a big part of this. There was a term that I've never heard before. What was it called? Feminicide? The killing of women?
Yeah, right.
Do you remember that word? I mean, I've never. Oh, yeah, here it is. In number 46, in this consideration of violence against women, one cannot condemn enough the phenomenon of femicide.
Yeah.
Okay, are we talking about like China where they you know, the one child there, they always kill the female baby? Or are we talking about like women in countries that are killed just for being women? I don't know. Did you guys?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm thinking that it's poorly titled. It says violence against women. We think immediately physical attacks, but there's also, of course, the other attacks that we refer to as things like rape and other forms of sexual violence. I think women are more susceptible to that than men, clearly. And so there's a way of speaking about that. But I think it's important for us to just emphasize that violence against other human beings, not just women, is a serious matter. And I think they should have titled it that. And then they said there are special concerns about today about the violence against women in certain cultures in this world where women are violently treated and are often the subject of sexual violence, rape, other forms of abuse. But I think that all forms of violence and rape and abuse, unfortunately, we've seen a lot of young men who suffer at the hands of other men this kind of sexual abuse.
Right.
And all of this should be roundly condemned. I think the word woman in there might have been better to just broaden it a little bit and say, this is all wrong. There are special things that women are especially susceptible to. Right. But at the end of the day, it's all wrong. That's how I would have.
Yeah, it's curious that he specifically says, I want to invite you to combat a scourge that affects our American continent, the numerous cases where women are killed. And then that's
the American thing.
Yeah. No further explanation or anything.
I just don't mean the fact that it's American. I'm not saying they're wrong, but I must be in the dark about a femicide in the United States of America.
I think he meant the Americas probably. Cause he's
the Americas. Okay. South America. Maybe. Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay. Well, the other thing was surrogacy. I thought that was an interesting attack against the dignity. Mm-hmm. It says surrogacy also violates the dignity of the woman, whether she is coerced into it or chooses to subject herself to it freely.
Yeah.
And the woman is detached from the child growing her and becomes subservient to the arbitrary gain or desire of others.
Yeah.
But here's the point. It says that each person's right to be recognized is never as an instrument for another, you know, like to use.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I guess would that also involve like in vitro fertilization, or is it, I mean, as.
Yes. It does. I mean, well, often it does, not always. Sometimes the married couple engages in some activities in the that gets the sperm and ovum fertilized in a petri dish, and then later introduced into the womb of the actual mother. So that wouldn't be surrogacy there. But the what surrogacy is when that embryo is placed into the womb of a woman who is not the biological mother. That's surrogacy. And again, a lot of people say, oh, what's the problem? It's a beautiful thing. You know, we always get flowery with this stuff, but we have to really examine. And I think the document tries to do that. And I'm glad, good for them. They should have brought this up because, well, as we know here in America, anyway, it's back in the news again with some court decisions, but also we have a candidate for the presidency who has come out in full-throated, you know, we should have all the IVF we can get for people because it's all about making babies. And isn't that a beautiful thing, he says. Well, it is, but it's not being done in a beautiful way, and it's being done in a way that sort of cheapens human life and human sexuality, whereas every human child deserves to be conceived in the intimate embrace of the marital act and raised by its own father or mother, and being conceived in a petri dish. I'm sorry, there's not a lot of dignity in that. And the fact that other embryos are often either put in a deep freeze, that's undignified, if we're using this word. And likewise, many of them are either later discarded sometimes used for genetic experimentation. This is creating a lot of problems because this is not what human beings are not a product to be developed. They are a gift to be lovingly received from God in the way that God has set forth, namely the marital.
It says that too. It says that because of this unalienable dignity, the child has the right to have a fully human and not artificially induced origin, mm-hmm. as to receive the gift of life that manifests both the dignity of the giver and that of the receiver. And it's really interesting. I remember years ago when IVF was just starting to become popular, and it's very prevalent today. There are many, even unfortunately, Catholics that I think they unknowingly do it, right?
I think so. Yeah.
But they just do it because you never hear it preached about. I remember the guy, Father Tad, said the reason that IVF is wrong is not, I mean, yes, obviously that some of these embryos get put on the freezer and there's the self-abuse, mm-hmm. get the semen and all this other stuff involved. But he said that's sort of secondary. He said that every child has the right to be loved into existence in the way mm-hmm. that God designed. That's the primary mm-hmm. offense, is respecting the mm-hmm. conjugal act as being that everyone has the right to be mm-hmm. purposely brought into existence in that manner, not in the manner as we're going to, mm-hmm. Through a sort of a science project, make you.
So I know we're kind of like with contraception, where the Catholic Church is standing here holding the candle all by ourselves while everyone else is off saying, what's going on over there, man? I know that we're very counterculture on this, but we need to stand our ground. And I think it's an important part that we're very consistent in this. It isn't just ending a life in abortion. It's also toying with life at the other end of the spectrum, that's trying to force something that God apparently is saying to the couple is not what he wants for them. Yeah. Maybe an infertile couple is called to adopt, or maybe they're called to, maybe God is asking them to become, because they don't have children, more involved in some missionary work. I don't know, but some discernment is needed, but God speaks in what is. And right. I think somewhere we're just frustrated, people shake their fist at this, and there's just a lot wrong with it. And again, I think you're right, Father. Most Catholics don't think through this. We haven't maybe preached about it as often as we should, because it is a fairly specialized moral topic that isn't really for a typical Sunday necessarily, but it would take a long time to unpack it all. And so I don't know the best way we can get this out, but we have a lot of work to do in recovering the idea that human sexuality has been abused, turned into a form of entertainment, and set aside, is no longer connected with childbearing, and that's a problem. But also, childbearing is often not being connected properly with the human sexuality in the Marriage Act. And we've got to get them all back together. We have separated what God has joined together. Being married, having sex, and having children is all meant to be together, and we have separated it. And we're in a big royal mess right now.
Yeah. I didn't really mention anything about about that, but it would have been interesting if they tied in, you know, the, and that's, that may be too complicated and too jammed in there, I think, but mm-hmm. you know, the idea that even the marital act, there's a violation, is it goes against the dignity of the human person.
Yeah.
And, but anyway, yeah. So what was the other thing here?
Well, there are a couple more that are really important. There's, I think maybe a brief word on migrants, but also then we need to talk about gender theory, which I think is the document plows some important ground on.
Right, right.
Go but ahead. In terms of migrants, the only thing I would say in the document is that it does, it is a document about human dignity. So let's remember the context. But they're saying basically, I think, in a very one-sided way, that migrants have this dignity that should just be respected without, you know, limits. Which means, you know, kind of just let them in. But if you read the catechism, there's a balance to be maintained. And the catechism speaks of two things about what the church says about the teaching on migrants. Migrants, first of all, that wealthy nations such as ours should be very generous in receiving migrants who come either as refugees or sometimes just seeking a better life. And we should be as generous as we can in receiving them. However, the document also says, or the catechism, I should say, that there should be among those who come to the country, obeying of just laws, following of procedures and policies to migrate or to enter the country, and following just laws and customs of the nation that they make their own. And so I think if we find there's dignity on both sides, you know, Americans have dignity too. And having our laws just violated and seeing the kind of chaos we have at the border, but also now in many of our cities and so on, where we're overwhelmed and we can't properly help people, that's an attack on dignity too. So it's okay to ask that there could be an orderly process other than just the open borders we have today, and that it be done in a way that respects the human person and human dignity. This disorderliness that we have is very much an attack on human dignity. And there's so many people being exploited by that very fact, trafficked and treated as sex mules and sex slaves, and not just that, but I mean drug mules, you know, where they secret the drugs in their body, just all kinds of terrible human abuses that come from a disorderly immigration process. So I think they could have expanded this in a way that came off more holistic than a more, what it sounds to me, more like just a political open borders answer.
Well, it kind of continued the absolutism that we talked about earlier, and that it was just, you know, across the board, there were no mm-hmm. caveats put in place for.
Yeah. And finally, just before looking at gender theory, I think it makes some very good statements about abortion and euthanasia and assisted suicide, the dangers associated with them, especially with the suicide thing. You know, your so-called right to die becomes my duty to die. And also, what does that say about those who are chronically ill or sick? You know, should they just, you know, take the injection? I mean, what are we saying about the dignity of the handicapped or the chronically ill or those who have struggles in life that their life has no value? No. Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff implied in this, oh, just let people do what they want. You're being cruel, you know, and this kind of stuff. And we end up with a very dark world very quickly because we're putting into man's hands what doesn't belong there. And human beings start to decide your life has value and yours doesn't. You should go on trying to live. You should just take the pill or take the shot.
Yeah. And I just noted something too. Here, you know, as you're speaking about, you know, these violations of dignity, I went to the gender theory again. And it's interesting. In number 55, it actually does quote a section from the paragraphs and I believe, I didn't look it up, but I'm almost positive this is from the section on homosexual activity, because it says the church wishes, first of all, quote, to reaffirm that every person, regardless of sexual orientation, okay, ought to be respected in his or her dignity and treated with consideration, while every sign of unjust discrimination is carefully avoided, particularly any form of aggression or violence, unquote. So, and then it goes on, for this reason, it should be denounced as contrary to human dignity that in some places, not a few people are imprisoned, tortured, even deprived of the good solely because of their sexual orientation. It kind of slipped that in.
Yeah. And so you've kind of jumped now to the whole gender theory section. Yeah.
So my question, why would you, but it didn't really say that's all about homosexuality. And then it jumped.
Well, yeah. I think they borrow the language there. I certainly do think so. Okay, I think we can all affirm, though, that, look, if someone's struggling with various forms of gender dysphoria, you know, we shouldn't mock them or ridicule them or laugh at them. They have a problem. And I think lovingly in the past, we used to say, well, this person's a little misguided and we can try to help them through this period. But today, again, so many come out celebrating and so on. But I do think even despite all that, that, you know, the human person is still involved here. There's a human being there and they're either misguided or lost themselves. But we should try to, let's at least give this disclaimer that just because we disagree vigorously with gender theory doesn't mean we say these people have no dignity. And I think that's a valid I hate to just use the word disclaimer, but I mean, we want to make sure that, you know, we're trying to distance ourselves from this. You don't agree with me, so you're engaging in hate speech. You know, no.
Right.
We're engaging you because you do have dignity. You're a reasonable human being who ought to be able to have a reasonable discussion about this, would be my answer to them. Okay. So I don't.
Yeah.
Need to, but I see your point, Father. I think, it is borrowed, though, I think you're right, from the Catechism's language about homosexuality. Because remember, when the Catechism was written, there wasn't as much of this insanity that we have. And I'm going to use that word clinically here. You know, it is insane to think that a man can actually be a woman. It just, you know, so we didn't have all that when the Catechism was written. At least it wasn't out there in large numbers. And I think it's come now. And I think maybe it is something of an offshoot of same-sex attraction and sexual confusion.
Right.
But anyway, so they borrow the language. Yeah, I agree with you.
Right. So jumping into why is it that sex change would be a violation against one's dignity, as and it just says in number 60, the dignity of the body cannot be considered inferior to that person as such. And it goes on to say that the human body shares in the dignity and image of God. And that comes in the body that God gave us. You know, even though it's falling apart, the body still has this intrinsic dignity, right? So, how would you unpack this? You know, why they're saying that the sex change ideology and the action of being done is against the dignity of the person.
Well, two statements I'll just highlight here. First of all, about gender theory in general. Okay, so gender theory. There is this disrespects the body, which clearly distinguishes between male and female, not 50 different genders, right? So the document says gender theory envisions a society without sexual differences, thereby eliminating the anthropological basis of the family. And so basically it's saying, you know, whatever God has given us is just throw that away and we're going to re-envision the whole thing in a way that's just kind of make-believe in a way. It, obviously, there is sexual differentiation, not just biologically, because they're going to say another thing here about the soul in a moment, but it is certainly biologically expressed, but it expresses something that comes from God, from the natural order that says that human beings are distinguished according to two kinds, male or female. And to throw all that away is to engage in a gender theory that is, again, eliminating, they're using natural law language here now, but eliminating the anthropological basis for the family. And also then from God's work of creation. So we're just saying all that doesn't count. Who cares what the body says? That's irrelevant. It's just what I think, what I feel. It's pure Gnosticism, to put it in theological language. The body is nothing. In fact, it's nothing but trouble. Ignore it. Do what you please. But if only we could be free of it. The body is evil or bad or indifferent, to be indifferent to it. All that matters is what I think, my own theories and so on. Well, that's just pure Gnosticism. Now, as far as sex change, they also say this, you know, the idea that you can just change your gender, your sex, by changing your anatomy, you know, the external anatomy, It says humans are inseparably composed of both body and soul. In this, the body serves as the living context in which the interiority of the soul unfolds. And so we must learn to respect both the natural order and what God has handed on, and also that creation is prior to us and must be received as a gift. So we don't just make up the way things are. We inherit something called creation and the created or the natural order to which we are obliged to conform. So that's the kind of principle that's being used here. And the gender theory crowd, as well as the those who engage in sex change and all this, seem to think that there is no real importance to be given to the physical or natural order in this matter, that we're simply to just discard it and do whatever we please. And there are limits to what we can do. We can maybe take medicine and learn how to get rid of a headache, but that's assisting the natural order. It's not changing or going against it, you see?
Right.
And so this is where I think the document has some important things to teach. Some of it's heavy philosophy, but part of the reason we're in this trouble is that nobody's ever studied philosophy anymore. you gotta do a little bit of thinking about your thinking every now and again. And otherwise you get into some weird contradictory stuff that doesn't make sense. They all say, follow the science. Well, they don't mean it here. Because that's not what the science reports.
Right. So it's kind of, wrapping up what you just said there is that, this person going back to their ontological reality, they can change their gender, they can, cut themselves up to drugs or whatever it might be to make that happen. Yeah. Their dignity is not destroyed as a person, made in the image and likeness of God, but they're destroying that outer, that existential dignity by destroying what God, is good in itself, and making it and just changing and destroying it.
Well, and it even it kind of strongly worded when it says desiring a personal self-determination, as obviously gender theory does, amounts to making oneself God. I mean, that's pretty strong.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's true with, I think, most of these issues, right? I mean, especially things like suicide. I don't think my life's worth living. Ergo, God doesn't know what he's doing with my life. He's the author of life there, but I don't care. I'm going to take it under my conditions. Abortion could be looked at that way. I don't know. Even with the whole thing with women, in some ways, it's like, I'm not going to treat God's gift with the way it should be, but underneath his dignity. So in a sense, all was like sin is actually playing against God, I think. I'm going to do it my way. I thought it was interesting. I don't know if you guys saw this. I was kind of looking at the tabloids to see how the society was reacting to this document. Of course, it was, they're like, the document says no to gender theory and surrogacy,
and that was it. No one covered the other part.
Yeah, they're just like, there you go, once again. Well, we said no to a lot of things, but here's what Bishop Barron said. I thought it was kind of interesting. On the news, he said, how stupid it is to see the church as left or right. You look at this document, and now if you're looking at this document with a political standpoint, you're like, well, I don't like that, or this or that. But it kind of covered every issue in the Catholic social teaching, basically saying, we're not Democrats or Republicans using the American, political system. We're Catholic, and this is how Catholics address these issues, right? I know, Monsignor, that's a big topic in your preaching when it comes to politics. You want to just say a word about that?
Yeah, well, I think people are much more passionate today about their politics and their faith, and so their politics is always going to, pardon the expression, trump their religion or their faith. And if you look at this document, I mean, I've been critiquing the document at some levels. But sometimes, as I say, this document can offend both the right and the left if you just take the political categories. I think it speaks of migrancy and war and the death penalty a little bit it's a little off. I mean, I don't disagree entirely, but I think I wish there were maybe more clarity. But on the other hand, it also it speaks in rather on the conservative side of issues when it comes to things like abortion, gender theory, sex change, and all of these kinds of things. It's pretty hard to categorize the Catholic Church we don't fit into anyone's little box, but people want it to be that way. And frankly, it's on both sides. I tend to be more politically conservative, and the people I kind of hang with, you know, we're going to be rah-rah about certain topics and like, oh, there we go again with other topics. And I think at some level we can all use a little bit of, comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable is what good prophets do. And we're all a little bit of both. And I think Barron is right. A document like this kind of shows how we just don't fit into the worldly things. Part of that's, I'm going to just boast a little for a minute. Part of that's because we're older than this modern world. We're older and bigger than the modern world. We go all the way back in time to the beginning of human, you know, things in our Judeo-Christian past. And we're in every country, we speak every language. Our concerns are just not fitting into a little American political system that has all these nice little boxes. It just, we're too big and we're too old for that. And by the way, Jesus was crucified outside the city gate. He was hated by people who hated each other. The Sadducees and the Pharisees and the Herodians all hated each other, but they only agreed on one thing: Jesus has to go. You know, that's kind of our lot. You know, we're going to be both loved and hated by both sides at times. And that's kind of the nature of this, if we're Catholic.
I mean, even within the church, though, Monsignor, I think you would concede how we hear phrases that we haven't heard throughout the history of the church. And that is, you know, you hear people speaking of, well, the American church or the German church. You know, we do, while we are certainly universal, I don't want to say our differences, but our political and cultural differences seem to be a little bit more at the forefront in the church than they were.
Yeah, right. Father, before it gets too late, could I also just point out a couple of other things in the document?
Sure.
You got a minute? Digital violence. I had never occurred to me to think that something like that would be in a document like this, but it makes a lot of sense. And they do it at two different levels. They talk about how we interact on the internet and how awful that can be. But also, I want to read to you from paragraph 61. Digital media can also expose people to the risk of addiction, isolation, and the gradual loss of contact with concrete reality, blocking the development of authentic interpersonal relationships. And so again, you see a lot of that today. We live in this weird Gnostic world of ideas. People are just stuck, their face is stuck in their phone, and they don't have, you know, authentic interpersonal relationships. It's Facebook friends. Well, nobody has those anymore unless you're old. You know, but you'll get the idea. So I think that, notice it says that people do. They get addicted to things like YouTube and TikTok and all these kinds of things. And they just get lost in this little artificial world that feels very real to them. It lights up, it talks, it even talks back.
It ties in with one of the four types of dignity, which is social dignity.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. It goes back to the Lizzie Velasquez things in terms of abuse. But I also think it's interesting that, it makes you less of a human, like when you spend more time, which I think we all do in some ways, you know. We could spend so much time in just looking on a device or seeking connection in that way. I was talking to, I was doing direction with some kid, you know, these younger people, and I guess the kid was talking about how he likes rainy days because he can play video games all day. and I thought, okay, well, that's interesting. I asked him a question. I said, would you rather spend 3 hours hunting in the woods or playing video games? And it took him about a minute and a half to kind of, you know, and he said, well, maybe hunting, you know, and And so I goes, well, because, you know, I get to hold a real gun. and I was like, well, yeah, you might not shoot anything because you might not see a deer. But I was like, do you think possibly reality is better than virtual reality? And he's like, maybe, you know, but I don't think he was sold. You know, I don't think he was sold. And I think that, yeah, I think one of the problems that the church is pointing out in that last part is, our people's heads are not really in reality about what's best for the common good and what's best for human dignity.
Yeah.
We're up in a cloud, so to speak, literally.
Yeah.
In a cloud, an iCloud, rather than like what reality is supposed to be, you know. So anyway.
By the way, it did mention it has a substantial section on abortion, and we don't need to rehearse a lot of it here. I think our listeners are all pretty agreed with the church on this. But I would say there is an interesting insight it gives in paragraph 47. It says, today in many people's consciences, the perception of abortion's gravity has become progressively obscured. Okay, there's also the temptation of self-deception. And therefore, the prophet warns us, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. Woe to those who put darkness for light and light for darkness. And so it is, but I think they're very correct that people's consciences have been seared on this, and many prefer the darkness to the light. And when you really pressure someone to just answer a straightforward question, they've all got all kinds of weird rationalizations. What do you think that is in the womb? You know, they're all, you know, and lots of euphemism. And it's amazing, you know, how people have just drank the Kool-Aid on this stuff in such large numbers.
Right.
So anyway, enough said, but I think there's a lot of good things in this document.
And that's so weird.
I wish we were more precise.
And it's just so weird. You're right. Yeah. Watch him, the word salad come out of their mouth, you know, trying to describe what it is when anybody, especially now, people having
kind of a form of verbal squirming.
Right. But, you know, in today's technology with 4D ultrasound pictures from, you know, as early as, you know, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, but still it's just funny watching it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, apparently a picture is not worth 1,000 words.
No.
So as I say, these are the things but I think just to maybe conclude my, and then Father, it's up to you to make the grand conclusion, but I think this document has a lot to commend itself. And I would, you know, I'm being a little picky. I get it. That's part of my job, But I think some of the issues could have been maybe spoken of in a way that was more respectful of the full doctrinal tradition of the church, that didn't, you know, select from the catechism certainly, but neglect other parts. There's a few places where I think it can fall to that criticism. But overall, I think it's a good document that should be helpful. But I think you're right, Father. You also mentioned some people just say, well, they reject surrogacy. They don't want to explain to their readers why. God help their readers if they were really exposed to the Catholic teaching.
Even that section was very good. It was very clear, and it could sound a little bit harsh to some people, but it didn't. It was well done. So I gave the document a solid B. It wasn't. I don't think it was the in terms of enjoyable to read. I mean, could have used some pictures or or I don't know, some stories or anecdotes might have been nice, you know, just kind of, it's
like, at least this one, once you read it, you weren't scratching your head like the last one, and you know, felt the need, you know, there were immediate follow-ups, you know, this was fairly kind of straightforward, and that's what one in we're it's like four how many this year I'm just trying to think already. Seems like a lot has been coming out.
Well, there are a lot of these that come out more than we think. So anyway, so all right, folks. Well, I hope that helped you a little bit. I think it would be probably worthwhile. It's not the longest document in the world. It will take a while to go through it. You can, and it's got some really beautiful points about your dignity, my dignity, everyone's dignity as a human person, but also violations against it. Might be a good talk at a parish in some ways, you know, about... especially if your parish is a social what do they call it? A social justice.
Yeah, social gospel or social justice.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you got to be fair. And I think one of the things this document teaches us is you really have to touch upon all the issues. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're going to say you're social justice, we got to talk about, you know, not just the poor, which it does, but we got to talk about the unborn. And we also have to talk about things like euthanasia and other offenses against human life. And so it's kind of refreshing to see something that really tries to hit all the different issues that can affect the human person. I don't think it was complete because I think it would have been another 20 pages, you know? So so Dignitas is Infinita on human dignity. And so you can find it online on the Vatican website, or I'm sure if you just type it in, you'll get a link somewhere. So thank you, Monsignor. Can we have your blessing?
Yeah. Pax benedictio Deo omnipotentis, Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti, descendat super vos et maniat semper. Amen.
Amen.